Hello everyone, thank you for coming to Russell's second class. Hello everyone at home. Living with Jesus is the continuation of Russell's presentation to us tonight. So we'll have a look at Luke chapter 10, from verse 25 to verse about 37. I think it's a Good Samaritan. Okay, thank you. And once again, Jesus uses the estranged Samaritans to tell his disciples and anyone who would listen a powerful lesson about service. So we'll now invite Russell to the front.
Well, good evening, everyone. And here we are again. So we're talking this week and last week about living with Jesus as part of your ongoing theme of vision. And what we're trying to do, if we can, in what we're presenting is almost give us a vision in the present, if that's possible. We talk a lot about visions for future, but I believe there is a compelling vision that we can have in the present, and to gain that vision, we just need to be more mindful and busy in our living with Jesus, and that would become our vision. And that then the vision of the future, which we always talk about as eternal life in the kingdom of God, but you can just say our vision of the future is living with Jesus forever. Well, we get the chance to start to live that vision now, and then the promise that we always talk about of the kingdom age and eternal life is really a continuation of that same vision. And hopefully what we can do as we think about this is that we can get out of this gulch of the present where we sort of feel as though the present is the letdown bit. It's the history has got a lot of things to learn from, and all the past is full of rich activity on the part of God, and we know the future's going to come and the kingdom's going to be great, and we're sort of stuck in this little gully in the middle where we can feel as though not much is happening. And what I'm trying to do is help myself really to see the present as a far more exciting place to be in. Because our life is only ever lived in the present. What's the phrase? We're thinking of, we don't have the option of any other life. It's the here and now, and it's the only place we've got to be. It's the only time we can do things. And so we need to make the present work, particularly with regard to our faith. Especially we need our faith to make sense in the present. And I say that because sometimes, again, we can understand how our faith makes sense in the past, and we can think about our past and how faith might have worked, and we can see how it works in the future. And sometimes our bit of uncertainty is where it stands right in now. And 2020 has really been a year for experiencing the present, hasn't it? Where the year that we thought we were going to have has not been that year. And actually, the present has changed a number of times through this year as circumstances in each of our lives have suddenly been different. And we want to make sure our faith makes sense in whatever present it is that we have. And it's the place where growth occurs and where action occurs. So that's why we're interested in it. So just to recap really from where we what we're presenting, if we were to think of a really simple core to faith in the present for the individual, so a very personal take, then the centering is on living with Jesus now. And it's got three influences which come to us. The first one comes to us from the past and is the focus of our talk tonight. The life of Jesus. When Paul preached the gospel, he talked about Jesus and the resurrection. So I've got those two things up there. How can the life of Jesus, how can we be inspired by example? How do we translate his life into ours? Then second, I pulled out the resurrection as really the core doctrine, because if we truly believe that Jesus lives again, then we saw the whole series of consequences that brings and the amount of assurance and confidence we can have when we have that belief. And then living with Jesus now, but also visions of the future to help inspire us in the present. One thing I want to just point out, though, is of course living with Jesus now is a space for action. It's not a space for another set of text. It's a space for doing. And so whatever we come to as a conclusion from tonight needs to be actions to take, not just more words. Just to look for a moment back at the Jesus lives again thing, and I said it's a core belief. The verse that we quoted last week was Acts 17, where Paul's gospel in the Athens market is he talked to them about Jesus and the resurrection. But at the beginning of the book of Romans, which for many of us is quite a complex book, yet in that first little introduction, Paul talks about the gospel, and he says the gospel of his Son, who's Jesus Christ, the Son of God, declared by the resurrection. So he's picked up those two elements in his brief summary of the gospel before he goes into his 16-chapter-long defense of that basic gospel. And in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 8, this is the whole verse. Remember Jesus Christ, says Paul to Timothy, risen from the dead, the offspring of David, as preached in my gospel. So when we say the life of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus are core, then Paul here three times then picks out these two aspects to do. Part of this task has been to think about doctrine in a personal sense. We're all very familiar with doctrine in a corporate sense. We have our statement of faith, and we have all the details that we know of the teachings of the Bible. It's worthwhile as a project at some stage to think about how you would write those doctrines simply in the personal sense. We talk quite easily about the mortality of man, but it's a different thing, isn't it, when we come to say, I am dying. We can debate with many people about the lack of a fallen angel that brings about temptation, and we're familiar with all these verses. And it's another thing again when we come to the simple realization, I battle with sin. And let's see, and similarly, we've filled up books full of discussions on the atonement. But it's a great moment when you can actually come to the point where you realize that it means that you can be at peace with God. And so while we have many doctrines, actually when you bring it down to the personal level rather than the corporate level, which is seeking to define out every possible error, but you're saying, in myself, actually doctrine can simplify quite a lot. And just for a moment, in terms of that vision of the future, as you've looked through the course of this year, there are many different things that we can look forward to in the future, whether it's the restored earth or whether it's justice and peace, whether it's meeting people that we once knew who have died. Various different visions we can have of the future. And just to remind us that really their purpose in the present is to be a motivating force for action. They're not meant to be something to escape into. They're meant to motivate us in the present to be active. And the thing that we saw last week in terms of the vision of the future is that many of the New Testament writers, their key vision is actually being able to continue their life with Jesus. So if we go back to here. So here is the overall, and then so here we are. This is the rest of this evening then. Drawing the line between the life of Jesus past and living with Jesus now. And I really thought that this would be the easiest part of the study. There'll be a simple line. Easily flick our way through the Gospels, and out would come the set of principles by which to live. In some things it is that easy, and in other things it's a little more challenging. And I hope there's probably not very much new that I can say on a talk which is essentially the Gospels and what they mean for us. I doubt that there's very much new that I can say, but hopefully a couple of new perspectives will be useful to you. And so the life of Jesus is presented to us by the Bible. In Hebrews chapter 1, it says that the word that was spoken through the prophets was at sundry times and in divers manners, but that God spoke in these last days in a Son. And so Christ is the greatest revelation of God. This is now not God speaking in text, this is God speaking in a life. And so we are, in the Bible, given the story of his life to be able to look at. It's a pity sometimes that we can sometimes end up turning it back into just a study of text, because the point of bringing the Word made flesh was to see the Word living in a person. And hopefully, for those of you who have done some homework through the last fortnight, have enjoyed the fact that you can, of almost rediscovering the person of Christ through the gospel records. Not just sets of statements, but looking to see the life that is being portrayed to us. It's a life of great balance. There is the full range of emotion is presented by Christ, from rejoicing to despair, from anger through to great tenderness. On display is justice as well as mercy. In Christ we see times where he speaks out and we see times where he is silent. And so the life of Christ is a great display of what we would call wisdom, how to choose when and what to do. We're not given one life of Christ, we're given four, and they're fascinating documents of themselves, so closely connected to each other, and yet each one with a different angle. And here's the thing that I want to just sort of, I'm not sure if I'll say this right, but I hope you can understand. We're coming to the gospel records, which is where we're spending our time tonight, in order to connect the life of Jesus to ourselves. We're reading them in order to learn how to copy him. And that's a good thing to take into the Gospels. But the question I have is that the reason for which the Gospel documents were originally written? Is that what the writer is trying to persuade the reader? And I think some of our difficulty when we come to the Gospels and we're simply looking at it from a devotional point of view, I want to follow in Christ's steps, is that you'll find some chapters are full of content that we can say, oh yeah, this applies. And other ones you have to search more carefully in. And it's just to remind ourselves that the purpose that we've got in coming to the Gospel is not necessarily the reason that the writer had for writing that particular document. And we'll look at this a little more as we go along. So what was the reason for the Gospels being written, by the way? How many of the Gospels actually tell you what they're written for? Which one's that? Okay, Luke's got a good little introduction, hasn't he? Yep. John's got a little bit right at the end, where he says, this is what I've written to you for that. Matthew, when you start to read it, you'd say, here's a person trying to prove to a Jewish audience that we're dealing with Messiah, because there's lots of quotes and a very Jewish angle of things. Mark doesn't say why, but his goal seems to be to betray Christ, Son of God, the one with authority and power. Yes, God's servant, but when you're God's servant, this is what you can do. And so each of the gospel writers has got their audience in mind, and their audience is not necessarily us in the 21st century. Their audience is probably an audience that needs convincing that Jesus is Christ and that he's Son of God. And so a lot of their time is going to be spent trying to convince their readers of things that we're probably coming to already assuming. And so that's why we'll find there are sections of the Gospels which feel more rich with immediate relevance than others. Here's another thought, and it's really just a sideline thing, but the story in the Gospels of the disciples is of disciples who become believers. That is, people that were won over to the teaching and the example of the life of Jesus, gradually becoming persuaded that he was the Christ, the Son of God. So you can think of it with Peter, right? He's there through the Gospel story, but in Matthew 16 is the point where Peter's declaration, you're the Christ, the Son of God. And if you think about it, the Gospel of John similarly finishes with the climax of the story is actually Thomas and his belief right in the end of chapter 20 of John's Gospel. So they were disciples first and believers second. They were people that followed the life of Jesus first and adopted the theology of Jesus as they went away. And I put it there just as a point of interest, really, because much of the time, often we try and go the other way, don't we? We try and create a believer and then tell them what the duties of discipleship are. And sometimes I wonder whether we've kind of quite got that round the right way. Definitely the disciples in the gospel are disciples first. That is, people that follow and adhere to the teachings of Christ, and they are persuaded at the end that Christ is who he says he is. So, for those who wish to, the challenge was to browse through the Gospels and just observe the character of Christ, and to try and summarise down some teachings as you read them. If you have a really good memory, last year we put up a little graph that showed the time course of responses to the homework question. This year we don't need to, because it's exactly the same sort of graph. So don't need to do that. But the usefulness of it as a task, and I'd encourage anyone that hasn't to do it, is we're so familiar with the text of the Gospels that sometimes it's hard to read it new. You know, as we read the parable of the Good Samaritan there, you know, you already knew that the Levite was going to come after the priest, that there's oil and wine, and it's two pence, and we're so familiar with the text that sometimes it can be hard to pull relevance out from it, because our minds are there. Now, here's our challenge. In the Gospels, we've got actions and conversations, interactions, teachings of Jesus, and we want to motivate our life, and in it are actions and conversations, interactions, a fairly similar sort of list of things. And yet we realize that there is a gap between these two. This almost makes them look parallel, but there are some aspects of the life of Jesus which are not like ours. When he teaches, he can teach with authority. He can perform miracles. He knows people's thoughts. He has clear insight. And so this arrow of transfer from the life of Jesus to ours is not just straightforward. When someone comes to him with a problem, he says, "Sure, I'll fix that." Now, we can't do that. We want to follow Jesus, but he walks on water and he raises the dead, and that's not in our scope. And so we need to read the Gospels for what it is that we can follow Christ in. We also have to bridge the gap of time and space. Right. So, life of Jesus is taking place how long ago? This one's the easy one. Yep. How many? That was the hard one. I don't know. But it's a place far, far away, and it's a long time ago, and it's a culture and environment very different to ours, and somehow we've got to read this, what would otherwise be called an ancient story. How many other stories do you read of people's lives of 2,000 years ago? Like you read, no, probably you don't read, but you know, even go back into, I don't know, a Charles Dickens into Victorian times, or a bit further back. And these are foreign times and different attitudes. And we say, yeah, we can easily connect the life of Jesus to ours because it's really simple, and it's actually not. Some things transfer quite simply, but many of them we've just got to take a little bit of time. Now, a modern approach, and that sort of ever really adopted as a community, is to just try and reread the life of Jesus in terms of what we'd prefer. Now that's a very contemporary approach, right? So the Good Samaritan. Well, of course, the Samaritan was good because he was of the rejected sort. Well, no, just because you're a Samaritan doesn't make you better or worse. On there. So what we want to try and not do is take what we think is good and then just into the life of Jesus. We've got to resist that urge. So it should be a cross against that first one. But also, this is more of a danger for us, I think, because we like our text, is that we can end up with Jesus staying in the Gospels and in the world of the Gospels and never really being able to break free out into our life and our environment. Does that resonate a little? Is that we say, well, we know exactly what Jesus did here and here and here, and we know all of his sayings, but we've left them back there 2,000 years ago in Palestine, and bridging the gap to the actual things that bother us today and the actual trials that we face, the actual opportunities. And sometimes we've got the answer sitting right in front of us, but we don't see it because we haven't been able to complete this process. So we need to find a way of translating his life into ours if we're going to live with him in the present. Now, so when something is afar off and we need to make it easy to see, what do we use?
Binoculars.
Good. Right, so here we are. Here is the telescope. I want to talk just a moment about telescopes. What's the important ingredients in the telescope? Yeah, how many would be in this telescope? Okay, really basic telescope. Can't go less than two. Right, you've got to have one at the eyepiece end, and you've got to have, should do it around the other way because I'm going to call it around the other way. You can call it lens one and lens two. Is the tube really useful? Only for holding the two lenses in the right relationship to each other, really. Yeah, yep. Because the lens one is going to have a certain point of focus and you need lens two to focus on that in order to do it. But a telescope, whoops, is all about these two lenses. If you'll for just 30 seconds of optics. What do the two lenses do? So one, the objective lens, takes the image from afar. So here's our pirate ship. Right. And it's going to bring it to a point of focus. And our with our eye. To see image. Right? So if I'm not in the way. So lens one takes the object from a long and inside the tube. Right? And then lens two allows us magnifies the image that inside the tube to allow us to do what we want to. I think in terms of looking at Christ and ours, we need to adopt the telescope. And that is to be consciously realizing that we need to apply two lenses. The first one is taking the things that we read of in the Gospels, the story, and turning it into a little object that is now detached from that period of time. And I'm going to call that a principle. Here, a concept. Right? What was it that story was teaching is now a principle. And this principle now should be immune to the time and the distance and the change of technology and all of those things. But then secondly, and I think we do that, we do need to put effort into lens two of spending quality time examining the principle, seeing how it can work now. And so let's have a little look at this. So what are some of the issues that lens one deals with in terms of looking at the Gospels? We're trying to extract or crystallize a principle. This is where it's from the text. We need to figure out the translation, know what the words mean. What's the context of the place? We need to understand the different world and so what things mean in a certain time and place. Sometimes it's going to mean we need to extract out those things in the gospel story that apply uniquely to Christ. Actually not something that we can Down the bottom, we need to make sure that we're only picking up those things that have moral relevance. So we're not picking up other details, making them the hero when they're really not meant to be part of what comes through. And we'll give an example of some of these things in a moment. This point on phase is, I think, I don't know if it's the best term for it, but the story of Christ in the Gospels is Christ needed to come and to be rejected by his people and suffer the death on the cross. And so there are elements to the Gospel story that are moving the chain of history in that direction. They're not necessarily things that we need to replicate because that story's been told. Does that make sense? Yeah. In one place, Jesus says, I speak to the people in parables so that seeing they'll not see and hearing they won't hear and they won't understand. And there are times where Christ is he tells people, don't go and spread this news or that sort of thing. Now, you'd say, are these principles that we would drag through? It's like, let's make our gospel preaching as cryptic as possible. Let's make it a real puzzle. No, we try and spread the gospel as clearly as we can. But we say, oh no, just be quiet, don't tell anybody else about this. No, so we need to be careful when we're reading in the gospel stories to make sure we're not just picking up elements of the gospel story itself, what's happening back then. We've got to pull the right things through into the tube of our telescope to help us live for Christ. So just as an example from the passage that we read, here are some conclusions we could reach from Luke chapter 10, the reading that we had. All right. Now, hopefully this will just sort of demonstrate some of the things. So we could decide that the gospel story is about good debating technique, and that as Jesus answered the original lawyer's question with a question, that that's therefore a good principle to take into all of our conversations. And so every time anyone just asks us something simple, we'll always ask them a question back that moves it away. No, it's in its right place in the story. But if you always answer questions with questions, you will start annoying people. All right? It's good in its place, but its place is probably quite rare. We could take a practical lesson out of the story of the Good Samaritan, couldn't we? Don't walk along alone on deserted roads. It's a good lesson, but is it the point? Obviously not, right? Oil and wine are excellent medications. Oh, there's people that will try and sell you Samaritan oil, you know. And, you know, the people have written up of the antiseptic properties of all of these things, and it was what they had at the time. Is it the best remedy? No, that's... You see how we've just got to be a little bit careful with our stories, because otherwise we can end up talking all day about the antiseptic values of the compounds in wine and the... and how it creates a poultice and does all these things. And the story's not about that. Right? So things has got to be tuned to what we're looking for. Here is one that I've heard many times as people have talked about the Good Samaritan. It's a beautiful type of the work of Christ in saving us. From the compassion of the Samaritan to the... To the care of the innkeeper, to the paying of the price when he rose on the next day in the morning, it says. Excellent. But is that what we're looking for with our telescope when we're trying to say, how do we follow Christ? Probably not. Right. We can be very busy looking at the text from these ways, but actually the point of the parable is there in that final verse where it says, Jesus said to him, you go and you do the same. Right? And so the Good Samaritan for us, for our purpose of trying to pull the life of Jesus into our life, comes down to a simple principle. Be actively compassionate in the moment. Right? And, you know, it's a big lesson because we can so easily be the Levite. Oh, yeah, that's a grade 4. No, I'm not qualified to deal with that. Or the priest, it's like, no, I'm busy for my next appointment. I need to move on. There's no point knowing all about the type in the Good Samaritan parable if we lose the lesson of being actively compassionate in the moment. And we'll come back to that. Here's another example. If you're in Luke, and it's earlier in the chapter. Right? In Luke chapter 9, verses 1 to 6, and chapter 10, verses 1 to 12, is the instructions of Jesus for how his disciples should go out preaching. And if we took a simplistic approach, which, okay, here's the instructions by Jesus on how to preach, but I've never heard a talk in an ecclesia that says we need to all head out on the road and go and stop off at whoever will first invite us in and stay in that house, eating and drinking what they put in front of you, without taking a change of clothes, until either the town accepts or it rejects the message. And so we say, well, here is clear teaching by Jesus. And this is the question of phase, isn't it? All right? Here is what he's asking the disciples to do in that point in time. We need to think about, well, what are the principles? I was speaking to a Jehovah's Witness once who was trying desperately to find some point of difference between ourselves and them to prove that I was wrong. And eventually he had me on this one. We preach two by two, door to door. And I said, yes, we don't preach two by two, door to door. And so he won that argument. Of course, they don't stay in people's houses, but I didn't think about that at the time. But we could look at this and we'd say, well, here is something that on the surface of it looks like straightforward instructions for Christ, from Christ to his disciples on how to preach, but actually it's not. And when you trace this through the New Testament times, eventually you've got Paul saying, if a man doesn't provide for himself, he's worse than an unbeliever. Because he says there are some of you who are not working at all, but you're going from house to house. And the period of time had changed. And so we just need to have a careful look on these. And of course, the verse in brackets is the one that if we'd all sort of agreed that this was the way we ought to preach, then need to recognize verses 35 to 36 of Luke 22, where Jesus says to them, when I sent you out with no money bag or knapsack or sandals, did you lack anything? They said, nothing. But he said to them, but now let the one who has a money bag take it, and likewise a knapsack, etc. Here's a change in phase. Here's a development of the story, and we need to be aware of those things. There's also lots of things that we need to just be attuned to. This is all about lens one and trying to get a view of this world. Not every debate we have these days is with a Pharisee or a Sadducee, and we shouldn't turn any person we're debating with into one of those two just because they were the categories of people that Jesus debated. We don't have Roman soldiers demanding us to carry their bags for the first mile. So we need to figure out what the principle is rather than taking it through directly. We usually don't have to wait for the bridegroom when it comes time for a wedding. So various different things that we need to think about in terms of this first lens That is taking the world of the Gospels and moving it into the form of a principle or an idea. For those who took up the challenge, it's interesting to when we look at the character of Christ in the Gospels, when we look carefully to try and find things to notice and principles at stake. And sometimes these things are not written on the surface of the Gospel. We have to think about it. So Ben noticed that a certain event took place, and it doesn't say he went into the town and he was coming from here before and he went to there afterwards, and it seems as though he went out of his way, he raised the widow's son and then moved on, and he saw in that the going out of your way for others. It wasn't he was going all that way just to do that thing. Even just the words in the beginning of the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father," says Christ. And in so doing, he not only talks about his relationship with the Father, but his relationship to the other people around as commonly children of God. So these are little details, aren't they? These are crumbs that we're picking up along the way. Because the Gospels don't do a lot of commentary about Christ. They just tell you the story, and it's for us to figure out. I really like this one, which was that Jesus always looks out for the little people. So whether we think about Zacchaeus or the woman of Nain or the widow with the two mites, he's there and noticing. But the story doesn't tell us that. It's for us to read and to pull out. Or his approachableness was another thing that was picked up. Now you've got to read carefully got to apply your lens pretty well to pick up these things as you read. So we've done lens one, and now we look at lens two. So with lens two, we're not looking 2,000 years away. We're looking at a principle, and we're now examining it closely to see what it looks like from our perspective. And lens two thinking is then trying to personalize the principle, to make it real in the present and to make it something that we can do something about. What's different? Well, the Jesus of now is no longer the Jesus beset by weakness. He is on the right hand of God, raised, and he is not to be rejected and to suffer again. When we look at biblical principles with lens two, then it's going to differ for each one of us. It's going to differ by our situation, what we have on hand to be able to act with. It's going to depend on our circle of influence as to where this principle can be applied or how it can be applied. As we look at the principle, each one, our own abilities and experiences, our own capacity, and even sometimes our own imagination as to how that principle could be used, are going to come to the fore. When we use lens methods, we're trying to think about how can this principle be put to work right now. Not how could it have been applied to the ecclesia 10 years ago. Not how will it work when I'm retired. But how does it work right now? And as I say, this year we've already had a number of shifts as to what our right now even looks like. Our circle of influence has changed. Our ability to do things has changed a number of times during the course of this year. And that should initiate on us a new lens two type thinking. The story in the Gospel hasn't changed. Still the same. But the circumstances have changed, or our circumstances have changed, and so we need to look and to think again as to how the principles of the life of Christ can be lived as things are in the moment. I'm going a little bit risky on this one, but we'll see how we go. I think there are different sorts of thinking that we do and different environments in which thinking can take place. Now, you might substitute for hammock a whole heap of different things that become your place of thinking away from the desk. But hammock was used in a talk I heard about difficult mental challenges and these three different states. So I'm going with it. Whenever we've got a challenge for our thinking, as it might be if we decide to take on how does the life of Jesus apply to now, first of all, there's what we can do at the desk. And at the desk, we can read, we can take in details, we can analyse, we can determine the facts. And that's really good, and that's probably really necessary to kick off, particularly lens one type thinking. But that doesn't get us all the way through to here. And sometimes what I'm calling hammock thinking, or the hammock time, is what's needed. I don't know where your hammock is, or what your hammock is, but we need, I suppose we would have traditionally called this meditation, but somehow the study desk has grabbed that role of meditation and says you study at the desk and you meditate at the desk. I think they're two separate things. You learn some details and you've got them in your head, but you need conscious time, so you can't go to sleep in the hammock. But you do need time to mull over what you think about. Sometimes we end up with so much new stuff coming all the time that we don't properly process. And the trouble is that when we've got what I'm calling hammock time, time to be able to think without all of the details, that's where our brains draw the connections, the relationships. That's where our brains find the applications. And hammock time is particularly for this lens two type task. We've done our study, we've extracted the principles, and what happens too often is we've done the next study and we've extracted the principles, and then we've gone to the next class and we've got a new list of principles, and what's missing is the time that says, right, okay, I've got three or four things to think about, and now I need to work out how they live in life. And of course, I've just got for completeness there sleep, because sleeping mind will do some of that for you. And if you've spent time at the desk, and if you've spent time in the hammock or in meditation, then you find that next morning you've got connections there that you didn't have beforehand. So, what if we're going to use our telescope and try and bring the life of Jesus into living with Jesus? How do we make a start? Well, here's my suggestion. You go through the process that we're talking about and find enough for yourself to get a handful of personal principles or proverbs out of the life of Christ. Here are four or five principles that I say, right, these are core to what Christ was about. And I say a handful because once we get much above a handful, we can't keep them in our head. And what you need for your hammock time is three or four clear ideas to be able to work through in your mind as to how in your life and within your circle these things can be put into application. So, study in order to get some personal principles. Take time in the hammock or walking in the garden or whatever the location is that allows you to think consciously, to mull over those principles in terms of how they can live for you. And then, each day, take up those opportunities as you see them. For my mind, ecclesial life, the ideal of ecclesial life is a place where we share those things that we've thought about and those attempts to seek opportunity with each other. Because that's the chance where we get to calibrate whether we've got our principles right or whether we're heading off in one direction or another. And it's where we can encourage each other. Christ put us in ecclesias so that we can share with each other what we see the life of Christ in our lives looks like. And so here I've got five principles that I've been working on. All right. So they're written in my words. So one of them is from our Good Samaritan. Be actively compassionate today. That's the lesson from the Good Samaritan. And it's there in large detail in Luke chapter 6, the golden rule. As you would that others should do unto you, do likewise. Bring unexpected good into the lives of others. So here it is. It's one thing that I can just keep. And when I get my moments of time, here's something that I can think, well, how does that work for me right now? Here's the second one that I'm thinking about at the moment. So I've called it, It's Your Work, Lord. And it was sprung off for me by the words of Peter in the early part of the Gospel. He says, Lord, we've been out fishing all night and we've caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I'll let down my net. And a recognition that Christ knows better and that it's not our task, but his, and we need to trust him in that. And for me, personally, there's a whole stack of bits of application that I can find for these things. Here's my third one. Look into Jesus' eyes. This talks about my connection to Christ. Look into Jesus' eyes is a thing I see happening in the scene of many miracles. It's the eye contact on the night of betrayal by Peter. It's the eyes that knew what was in man, and eye contact with Christ is really important. And there's ways that I can think about how that can turn into action in my life. Here's another one I'm thinking about. To make progress, step forwards. There's this really unusual set of phrasing in the scripture that, so to him who has, more shall be given, and that almost sounds unfair. But there's a way in which, in spiritual things, moving forward is the way that growth occurs. Stagnation leads to decay. And so Jesus says, ask and seek and knock, because that's the way that you'll receive and find and be welcomed. And his parable of the talents tells us that the talents that we have are not best looked after by wrapping them up and burying them in the earth, but putting them out to the market. And sometimes I need a reminder to step forward in order to make progress. Here's the last of the five that I'm thinking about at the moment. So make tracks that I'm happy for others to follow. The image is of someone walking their way up an overgrown hillside, beating away through the undergrowth, who turns to see that somebody else is now following along that track line that he's produced. When I see people following the tracks that I create, and this is very true in terms of family life and Every one of us creates tracks for others to follow. How happy am I that people are doing what I have done? Of course, it was Christ that kept on saying to his disciples, "Follow me." He berated the Pharisees. He says, "Do what they say, but not what they do." And he gave us the example of love. And so I just give you those as the five things that I've got sort of down condensed enough so that when I have those moments of time, if we call it hammock time, then there's only a handful of them. I can remember them and I can think about how can this work in my life this week? How can this work within my circle within these days? I don't have to translate them from Palestine 2,000 years ago. What's important for me is how can these live in my life this week? And so we draw to a conclusion. We might say, though, that taking the principles of Christ, making them live in our lives, is living for Christ. But our title is living with him. And I think there's a closer association yet. At the end of Matthew, Jesus says, "I am with you," but we need to see him there. And I think the final important thing for us in learning to live with Jesus is learning how to share and acknowledge to him both those things that we would wish to do in his name, share with him those actions that we do in the moment, and share with him our times of reflection and confession when things haven't gone the way that we wish they had. We've always been reluctant as a community to talk about communication with Christ. And so I'd say, learn to find a way to share yourself and your thoughts with Christ. If you need to, write a letter, keep a journal. Whatever it takes, we can spend our lives living for him, but we need that extra dimension that means that we're living with him. He says he's there, and all we need to do is to learn how to share those moments of life with him. Here's a sidetrack just as we finish. What I thought I was going to be able to do for looking at the key principles from the life of Jesus was just look up the epistles of Paul and see which moments from the ministry he picks up on in order to let him do the work for me and pick out what was important from the life of Jesus. Now, if you run your mind over the epistles of Paul, you'll find that actually they are very bereft of moments from the Gospels. Paul does not talk about Nicodemus or the feeding of the 5,000. The only place where he overtly talks about some words of Jesus, he quotes words that aren't in our Gospels, which is more blessed to give than to receive. You won't find it directly in any of our Gospels. And so that was a bit of a disappointing find. So the Gospels give us accounts of the life of Jesus without giving much commentary. They leave us to figure out the principles for ourselves. But by contrast, in Paul's letters, he doesn't talk about the individual acts and words of Jesus so much. And he does the job for us, lens one and lens two sometimes, converting the life of Jesus into a set of principles. So if you cast your minds through to, say, a Colossians 3, then you'd know that putting on Christ means to put on gentleness and forgiveness and forbearance and all these things. he's done for us. So that when we read in the epistles about Christ, we've had lens one applied to the life of Jesus for us. And then in most of the epistles, it'll then go on to say, husbands, love your wives, children, obey your parents. Starting to do a bit of lens two for us, isn't it? Is that here are some principles and here are some places where they can be applied. And so I thought, just as a point of balance, these are both good things. The Gospels give us a picture of Christ and we've got to sort out the principles. And if it gets a little bit tricky to do that at times, then Paul can come to the rescue in his letters and give us the principles already sort of cut and dried. Peter and John's epistles are different. So Peter is a mixture of the two, his experiences plus principle. And I'll leave someone else to talk about John. So here we are. Final one. So find a simple way of understanding the gospel that helps us in the present. I believe we can. I believe if we can keep in the center of our mind the belief that Jesus is raised, and therefore that makes everything else come real. If we can have enough of a vision of the future that motivates us to be busy in the present. But even more than that, if we can find a way of pulling the life of Jesus into our present, of extracting from the Gospels those principles that we consciously make work in our lives, then we end up with a vision that exists for us, not just for the future, but in the present. If we can live with Jesus now, then we will abound in his work. And we will be those that love his appearing, because it will just be a continuation of the work begun. And so in Thessalonians, Paul writes, God has not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation. What is salvation at the end of the day? It's that whether we wake or sleep, we might live with him.